You're listening to a 3CR podcast of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations people's connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT.
Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
Radio MMT at gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us. Welcome to Radio MMT. And how are you this week, Anne?
Kevin, hello. I'm doing all right. It's gotten a bit chilly lately. And hello to our lovely listener. Thank you for joining us wherever you are, whether you're listening to the live broadcast or the podcast.
Hey, this time last year, Anne, I was stuck in the Dandenongs in Melbourne and the days were getting shorter, the weather was getting colder. And van life seemed a little less appealing at that particular time. You don't want to get stuck in Melbourne if you live in a van.
And why is that, Kevin?
Well, because a van's quite a small area. It's like if you've got a bit of a buffer between you and nature, it's okay. And I don't have any windows in my van. I only have skylights in my van. It's good for a couple of reasons. It's good for privacy. It's good because you can use the walls to store more things. But it's bad because you can't see outside. So if you can imagine living in a place which only has skylights and no windows, then you feel a little bit enclosed. And so it's best for me to have the doors open so I can look into the great outdoors. And when it gets cold, you got to keep the doors shut because it's cold. And then you feel a bit boxed in, man.
Oh, I thought you were going to say it's because you're actually feeling cold, but it's because you're feeling boxed into your little cell.
Well, I can make my van nice and cozy. It's got a gas oven and ventilation. I was thinking of putting a proper heater in, but I use my gas oven for warming the van. And it gets quite cozy quite quickly. So that's not a problem. But then, of course, every time you open the door, bang, it's cold again.
They can make roast potatoes and get warm at the same time.
Yeah, it is nice. But you don't want to be doing that all the time. You feel a little bit captured. It's nice to have the option to fling the doors open and look at the beautiful countryside at a reasonable temperature, such as on the New South Wales coast.
Oh, for example?
For example, that's a better place to be, or heading up towards southern Queensland where, as they say, the air conditioner on your van is called your wheels.
So you are taking advantage of the fact of having a mobile home.
Yeah, so there's that. So anyway, have we talked about the weather enough, do you think?
Yes. Well, from the point of view of someone who's in a van, all these topics are very interesting.
The weather is very important, you know, and one thing you do notice when you're living in a van is you are connected with the outside world a lot more. It makes you a bit more conscientious of what is happening with the weather, which is important these days, Anne. And that ties us into our program, which is all about economics and what it's doing to the weather outside my van, which is...
That's a nice segue. I'll take advantage of that.
Last week, we were speaking with Brett Scott.
We were.
The independent thinker, Brett Scott.
Yes, we were talking about the kinds of alternative monetary systems that communities might be able to set up for themselves. And it's always good to understand how monetary systems work when you're going to do that. But in this second half of our conversation that we'll listen to in a moment, we are going to talk about what has come to be known as the war on cash. In other words, this decrease of recent years in the use of physical notes and coins.
It's kind of an interesting thing because I read that Graeber book, you know, 5,000 Years of Debt, and it described in that book that in stable times, hard currency like coins and notes, etc., weren't regarded as important. What was regarded as important were the ledgers, and that if you're in a stable environment, you could keep a record of, you know, what work you'd done or what you'd traded and settle accounts via ledgers. Mm. But it was only when times got unstable and say you're a soldier and you're traveling the world maiming and killing as you do as a soldier, you may or may not be there the next day. And so if you're going to be trading with somebody in an unstable environment, the person you're trading with doesn't care about a ledger. They want to see cold, hard cash. Mm-hmm. So that was what I took away from Graeber and the whole importance of cash, etc. But we're kind of in different territory now. The world's a different place. It's unstable, and yet we're seeing this shift away from hard currency to more digitized forms of exchange. So I sort of, like, my initial thoughts about hard cash was, well, look, if we've got this other system, do I really care? But after speaking to Brett, he brought some interesting insights.
I think he does. So let's have a listen now to Brett Scott. One thing that I've learned about monetary systems is that for the dollars that we use day to day, they come from two places. So they're created in two ways. We have the government spending dollars into existence, and we call that the fiat currency. And we have commercial banks lending money into existence, and we call that bank credit. And one thing we haven't really talked so much about on Radio MMT is what is the tension between these two institutional processes.
Yeah, yeah.
So the way I see it is, like, on the one hand, we've got the government should be regulating banks, and it certainly has the power to do that if it wants. But on the other hand, banks have become a very powerful lobby, and so now they've been very successful in getting the rules written in their favour. I don't know if you would frame it as this tension playing out in terms of what I think you call the war on cash. So in Australia, we now have large parts of suburbia and regional towns where they're lucky if they've got an ATM, and they might have to drive 200 kilometres to the nearest branch.
Yeah.
So this move away from paper money in towards digital money, I gather it's a worldwide phenomenon, so I'm just kind of curious as to what you've seen as far as this global war on cash.
Yeah, yeah. There's actually two big frames you can use to try to understand it. One is privatization, and the other is automation.
Mm.
The privatization framing, so if you're thinking about the existing monetary system, it's not a single system. So when somebody says, you know, the Australian dollar, it's not a single system. It's a composite system of different players that operate in different levels. But of course, in day-to-day life, we just call it one thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the different players involved in that, at the one level, there is the state, or the state institutions, central banks and treasuries and things like that. And if you're putting it in sort of basic terms, they're issuing the first layer of money. And historically, that's where something like MMT tends to focus, because that's where you have political sway.
Mm.
You can say, you know, we can get the central bank stuff to issue more of that and so on. Right? Then there's a second layer, right? The second layer is the commercial banking sector. The way I tend to describe that layer is as digital casino chips, because, you know, it's like they can issue out a sort of secondary type of chip. And that's what you would see in your bank account, for example. So if you're taking this basic idea that there's a composite monetary system and it has a sort of a state part and a commercial banking part, you can then see, for example, that they could be in competition with each other at some level. So the banking sector does rely upon the support of the central bank, but they have all their own agendas too.
Right.
They want people to use their digital systems. They actually find the cash system, which is the way you exit their system, essentially, they find it a hassle and they find it to be a competitor to them.
So physical notes and coins are a way of exiting out of the bank credit system.
Yeah, if you want to use the casino metaphor, the digital casino chips, you imagine going to a casino and you have cash and you hand it over to the cashier. They essentially take that from you and claim ownership of it, and they issue you chips in return. Now you have casino chips and they have cash. you no longer own the cash because you might lose those chips.
Right.
Right. You own the chips. Then if you come back with the chips, they'll give you cash. But like right now, they have your cash and that's theirs.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason why people actually trust the banking sector is that they believe at some level they can exit the system.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why you would hold a casino chip is not because you inherently believe that that somehow has purchasing power. It's that you can redeem it back into cash. If the casino said you can't redeem this, you'd be like, what is this thing that I'm holding? I mean, that's what happens in the banking sector at one level. If you go and deposit cash into a bank, they're going to credit your account with numbers. And those basically are chips saying you have the ability to come back to us. But the big thing the banking sector has, it has the ability to issue those chips without you depositing money. That's what they're doing when they're quote unquote lending, right? They're basically issuing new chips into existence without any change in their level of reserves. So it's like a casino just pushing out new chips without getting any new like cash coming in. That's what's sometimes called credit creation of money. And that's what creates the big second layer of the money system. Now, the banking sector has an interest in promoting that particular thing. And that means they often try to demonize cash in various ways, right?
Oh.
And this has created a problem because the cash system actually supports them in the background, because that's what psychologically and legally kind of anchors their own systems. But because they're private businesses, they don't really care. They're just like, oh, it's somebody else's problem. We'll like demonize this system along with the fintech industry and the card payments companies that facilitate bank transfers. But we don't care about the consequences to the stability of the monetary system or many other things that happen as a result of that.
Mm.
And so that's a big structural battle that's occurring. For example, if you look at things like CBDC.
Central bank digital currencies, yes.
Central bank digital currency would essentially be a new type of layer one money. Well, it already exists actually, but like it's not accessible to the public. And the commercial banks don't want you to have that because that would be a new competition to their own digital systems. So they're lobbying heavily against it. But this is one big thing going on, like in the sort of background to the war on cash. But there's also a much bigger thing happening as well, which is in a global capitalist system, there's an inherent drive to expand and accelerate all the time. Players like Amazon, Google, like they hate the cash system because they want to speed everything up. They want to automate everything. And something like physical cash, they see it as something they can't automate. And this is a tendency that spreads throughout the whole economic system in general.
You're listening to 3CR 855 AM on digital and on the internet. www.3cr.org.au.
So that casino chip metaphor, to realize that actually the so-called cashless units in your bank account are given power by cash itself.
Economic anthropologist and author of Cloud Money, Brett Scott.
So this is one thing people don't understand about the sort of the cash debate often, is that actually the state money system, the layer one money system, gives power to the layer two system.
Mm.
It's the thing that anchors the layer two system. And if you undermine that layer one system or stop people having access to it, it creates immediately big problems at a structural level. That tends to be harder for people to understand because it's not something they see in their everyday life. It's a more sort of background structural thing. That's the kind of thing that central bankers worry about.
Right.
All right. Now, if you're trying to go more to sort of the sort of everyday level of, you know, you're just a person in the monetary system and you're thinking, why should I care about the, you know, the background instability of the monetary system? The sort of metaphor I tend to start with is to think about cash as being like the bicycle or mountain bike of payments.
Mm-hmm.
And then the digital systems as being like the Uber.
Yes.
You know, typically the fintech industry and the big players who want to automate everything, they want you to think about cash as being like a horse cart and their systems to be like a sports car. They're like natural evolution. It's something that's just getting naturally better.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Why would you hold on to the older system? That's unnatural. That's something weird about that. But structurally, that's obviously incorrect. Structurally, their own systems are backed by the state system. But you know, metaphorically, that's what they're trying to use just to promote their own business interests.
That feels like the zeitgeist we're living in at the moment, especially since COVID. Like there's a pressure to not use cash at the moment.
Of course, yeah.
Mm.
And that's a structural pressure in a capitalist economy. They have to automate. Like, it's, you know, corporations are a bit like sharks. They don't necessarily have much control over their own processes. They're just like, well, if I don't do this thing, I'm going to be...
They just smell blood and start snapping.
It's just like they're operating on autopilot half the time, you know, and they have to then design ideology after that to tell themselves why they're doing certain things. So they're like, oh, well, because it's like progress. Progress ideologies tend to be these like after the fact explanations of the default processes of capitalism, where they kind of romanticize them. But the way to mess with that is to, for example, say something like, you know, hey, our society is full of things that are older that are actually very modern. Examples include like bicycles, they include things like stairs. So when you're calling for a cashless society, it's like calling for the end of bicycle lanes in the society or telling people to remove stairs from skyscrapers. Well, we have a more efficient system. We have Uber and we have elevators. Why on earth would you ever have some alternative system on the side? And that helps to illustrate actually a healthy monetary system. You want a balance of power between the different layers and the different players and the different forms of the money. Otherwise, you have domination. For example, imagine like Uber was the only means of transport in a society. That system would very quickly cease to feel convenient and would very quickly cease to feel empowering. It would actually feel incredibly oppressive and disempowering because you would have no option, right? And if there's total Uberization, you have immense amounts of power being concentrated into big corporate players. You have mass potential for surveillance, censorship type processes. You have huge resilience problems. You know, it can go down just from like single threat factors and stuff. You also have essentially a big attack on localization, because what they're basically saying is you can't have local interactions. Everything has to go through a huge central player. So if you look at, for example, a cash transaction, the issuer of cash is a central player, but once it's out in the world, it has an inherently localized way of being. You'll be in a small community, you're passing this unit around, but that interaction is local. Whereas if you're paying on an Apple Pay app, you're having to go through a huge central player thousands of kilometers away and then back again. It's inherently like taking a cut from every interaction in the local economy. And so these players have a massive interest in becoming the middleman between every single thing in an economy. So you really want to create counterpower to that. And to create counterpower, you need legislation to protect things like the cash system, but you also need to build a cultural movement that says, actually, it's totally legitimate and desirable to have an alternative.
Graeber, I think in his book, said that during stable times, there are ledgers and cash is not so important. During unstable times, you know, you're a soldier, you're on the move, you might be dead tomorrow. Nobody's going to accept a credit note from you. They want cash. But from what I'm understanding here, the ability to have cash will keep the other systems honest. And that if you remove the cash system, you then are totally in their hands.
Yeah. Well, but there's complexities to that Graeber statement. I mean, cash is a credit note, right?
Yeah.
It's a physical instantiation of a credit system. You can have a non-physical instantiation of that, which is like, if I issued you a promise, if I said something like, yeah, I promise to turn up on your show in 6 months, I could write it down on a piece of paper and give it to you, or I could write it down in an email. I mean, the promise exists. It could be instantiated in different ways, digitally or physically. So cash, in many ways, is the physically instantiated state promise or state tax credit, if you want to use a sort of MMT parlance. But you can also do that in a digital form if you wanted to. That would be like CBDC. It's the same underlying thing implemented in a different way. Now, those are all, in some level, like quasi-credit ledger systems. They don't perfectly map onto the Graeber example there, because sometimes what he's saying is like, if you don't believe the issuer is going to be there at some point, you don't want to take their notes, regardless of whether those notes are in physical or digital form. You just don't trust the issuer. But in our current system, where you have this multi-layered monetary system, where you have the state layer and you have the commercial banking layer, the two versions of money we currently have, you can use physically issued state promises, or you can use digitally issued commercial bank digital casino chips. All right. Or you can use like third layer systems like PayPal, which are just like a third layer of casino chips on top of the second layer. Those are your main options. Now, if you get rid of the physical state version, you're basically forced to use the second layer systems, which automatically transfers power, a huge amount of power, to the commercial banking sector. It already has too much power often in many places in the world. So that is not only a structural problem in your monetary system, but it's also giving way too much power to a particular industry. So if you want to prevent that, you got to protect that balance of power by policy measures. So for example, acceptance and availability of cash type measures. But you also actually need positive cultural messages about it. You need, for example, a central bank to come out and say, actually, the cash system is an important part of the overall monetary ecosystem, and we believe in protecting it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason that many central bankers won't do that often is that they're cowed by the banking sector, who has a different interest, and they want to maintain that they're neutral. So they say, oh, well, we shouldn't be out there saying what people should use. But of course, the commercial banking sector is constantly out there telling people what to use. So it's like a highly unequal situation.
The neutral gag they've got at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. So they're all like, oh, yeah, we can't do it. We have no power, blah, blah, blah. And so they're very problematic players. And often, of course, they're also influenced by the big tech players and the big corporate players who all push this ideology that says progress is ever more speed and automation and scale. Right. So you need to actually rewire our progress narrative to say that is one form of progress among many.
Mm.
Other forms of progress include resilience and balances of power, for example. So this is why I use these metaphors around bicycles versus Uber or like stairs versus elevators.
I'm James Juniper. I'm an economist at the University of Newcastle, and you're listening to Radio 3CR.
So you are with Anne and Kev, and we are listening to our conversation with economic anthropologist Brett Scott, who is just full of interesting ideas.
And we're talking about the tension between government spending and bank credit, money and where it comes from, either comes through government spending or through bank credit, which we did speak about in our show on April the 11th, Anne, where we had an analysis of those two forms of money and what happens when we adjust one or the other.
It's really important to understand this. It's something I had no clue about before I got into this modern monetary theory stuff, that our monetary system does have these two kinds of monies, or two ways of getting money into the system. And one of them you can think of as like public money, which we experience or we use as physical notes and coins. And then there is this other money, which is the bank credit, which is what Brett's calling casino chips, which is denominated in dollars and convertible back into dollars whenever a bank customer might want cash. But of course, the system is designed to be seamless so that we're not really seeing that there's these two kinds of money and that we might be going in and out of these two different kind of monetary systems.
Yeah, I remember we did a show a while ago with Phil Lawnd, and he was talking about the bank system. And he described it very well when he said that bank loans time shift spending.
Mm.
He said that without banking for anybody to purchase something, say you wanted to purchase a car or a house, that would take a long time to save up for, that you might spend your whole life saving for a house only to be kicked out and put into a retirement home. You can shift that spending because loans are made available and banks provide that service.
Mm.
But that function is essentially subcontracted out from the government to banks. It's a relationship that banks have with the government central bank that allows that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I remember when we started the show, it took us a long time to figure out what the hell bank credit was. We knew about government spending, but we really didn't have our heads around bank loans.
Very true. Yes, it's like the government's franchising out this ability to create money to banks. And as you say, it's a really useful thing for us to have in the community, because it does allow you to time shift your spending. And I think the idea too is that you've got these local actors in the local communities looking around and saying, what resources need to be mobilized? And the big discussion now, of course, is that a lot of bank lending is no longer productive because it's all about basically lending for people to purchase homes at higher and higher prices.
But when you think about it, if governments were in control of bank lending, they could, for instance, set home loans for owner-occupiers at a very low level and then increase loans for investors, investment properties, at a higher level, which would change the whole dynamics of the property market.
So there are a lot of improvements that could be made on this system. But I guess the point is just to understand that there are these two parts that are working together. And as Brett was saying, it's really the privatized money or dollars or bank credit that really relies on the government. So even though less than 3% of all transactions use cash these days and the rest are digital transactions, that means most transactions are using privatized bank credit. Even though the amount of bank credit is way more than the amount of government or public money in the system needs that public money to keep the financial sector stable because it relies on the faith that the depositors have in the banks. And that in turn relies on the faith in the currency, in the dollars. And that faith is as strong as whatever your national sovereignty is. And so, as Brett says, there's this incentive at the moment for the privatized players to undermine part of the public money system, and that part being the physical cash, the physical notes and dollars. So to understand what's going on with this war on cash, one, you need to understand that there's these two kinds of money. And the other thing is to understand that we've moved into this era of new technology. So these days, the advances in the fintech industry has given these big corporations a new way to make profit. And that is by being part of all these millions of small transactions that you and I, Kev, we do them every day, like buy a cup of coffee or buy an air ticket or whatever it is. The big corporations can now be part of these transactions at such a low cost that they can make a good profit. And now that they've discovered this new profit stream, they want to elbow out the traditional player, which of course is cash. And so the privatized sector of the monetary system is now highly antagonistic towards the physical cash or the public money system. And it seems like, you know, the government or at least the central banks, they're like a deer caught in the headlights of this sudden uberized antagonism.
It's probably the single point that drives home the importance of cash to me, which Brett Scott has explained, is that we've all seen it. We've all seen these little surcharges on top of the EFT payments that we make. It might be 3 cents, it might be 13 cents. It's obviously literally penny pinching by the banks just to pinch a penny here and pinch a penny there from every transaction, which over the millions of transactions is a good healthy margin for them. These things don't happen when you use cash. If I pay $5 for a cup of coffee, I pay $5. I don't pay $5.03. And the reason that those service fees will stay small and won't increase any further is because cash is still available. If we didn't have cash and I roll up to get a cup of coffee and they said that'll be $5.20 for your cup of coffee rather than $5, that service fee can just go up and up and up because there is no alternative. You've just got to pay it. If you've got cash, you can say, well, bugger you, mate, I'm not paying $5.20. And if they say, well, we only take EFT payment, I'll go, well, I'll go to a different coffee shop. So it's kind of like what the Democrats were back in the day. Keep the bastards honest. And if for no other reason, Brett has convinced me that the cash has a valuable position to play because it keeps those transactions honest.
Oh, I'm glad you got convinced on this, Kevin.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe we can see using cash as a way of sticking your finger to the big corporations.
And I like the way that he said that when you use cash, you remove yourself from the system and you can see this. If I buy something in cash from somebody else and they put that cash in their pocket and it's all done in cash, the banks have got nothing to do with these transactions. Yeah, we exited the system when we changed our balance sheet with the bank into hard cash and we're now operating independently of the banks and they can't profit from the transactions we make when we're dealing person to person with cash. I like that too.
Yeah, we exited the privatized system and went back into the public system.
Yeah. The other thing I liked Brett talking about was a retrospective ideology. He just mentioned it was a bit of a side comment. And he said, yeah, these institutions, they make up a reasonable explanation after the fact. When the real motivation for what they're doing is it's profit-driven.
It's always profit.
Which profit-driven equals greed. So they're trying to make their greed sound reasonable. and they'll do it afterwards with, oh, yes, but this is better for the system. Oh, it's more hygienic. Oh, it's more modern. Rubbish. It's more profitable. That's what it is.
Yes. He's really good at exposing the ideology of these players. Well, in a moment, we're going to hear him talk about other reasons why we should be concerned about this war on cash.
You're with Anne and Kev on Radio MMT.
At 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia.
And wherever you get your podcasts.
Economics for the rest of us.
Let's head back to our conversation with Brett Scott. So literally in 2022, there was a flood in the area of Lismore here in Australia. And I heard people saying who had experienced that flood that they needed cash to do their transactions because nobody could do digital transactions at that time.
Yeah. If you actually go and poll people and actually speak to people about cash and you analyze the way they speak about it, they do actually speak about it in the same way they would speak about things like bicycles and stairs.
Right.
They don't speak about it as something like a horse cart. Most people in society perceive it as one option that runs parallel to other options. They don't have a self-perception of it being this terrible, like, old crap thing, all right? Unless they've been indoctrinated in some kind of way by the marketing or they have a particular aspirational need to present themselves as being cutting edge, right? So certain types of urban populations have that, especially like upper middle class people have to present themselves as being cutting edge and ahead of the times because it's part of their like cultural capital. So if you rock up to like, I don't know, a Melbourne, I don't know, hipster bar, of course they won't use cash because it's culturally unacceptable for that particular strata of society. Whereas if you go to a different type of strata, they don't have this perception.
Yes.
So the reality is that most people actually perceive cash as an option. If they want to keep it, right?
Mm. I can give you a good example of a little ecosystem of cash users here in Melbourne, which is my local farmer's market. Every time I buy something off someone, they immediately reach for the little square card reader. And I will always say, oh, do you take cash? And I'd say 8 out of 10 times their eyes light up and they go, oh, yes, we do.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've been wondering why they're so pro-cash in that area. And I think it's because a farmer's market is trying to operate outside of the agricultural system as well. And so there's this sense of cutting out the middleman. And when I ask them why they prefer cash, they always say to me, oh, because we don't have to pay the transaction fee then.
Yeah, that's another part of it for sure. Most people in society actually have this perception, you know, but then it's like, where does the perception of it being something undesirable come from? You know, going back to the sort of stairs, who has an incentive to demonize stairs? I mean, the elevator industry.
Otis.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if you were a salesperson going to a building who doesn't have an elevator, what's your argument going to be? It's going to be like, oh, it's so tiring to walk up the stairs and it's so inconvenient. And like, this is what your story is going to be. This is your narrative.
Yes,
takes
right.
up space. Yeah.
Oh, people have accidents on stairs. They fall down the stairs. It's, of course, they'll have these arguments. And if you listen to stories about cash in our society, where do they come from? They come from the fintech industry,
yes,
who has an inherent interest in just showcasing one set of arguments like, oh, cash is dirty, cash is for criminals, cash is inefficient, blah, 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 blah. Like, what they don't talk about is like, oh, what if we only had a society with your system? It's like, we have way bigger problems in our society if we only had your system. So when people have internalized that narrative, and bear in mind, this industry is powerful. Visa, MasterCard, the banking sector, these are a very powerful industry. They're way more powerful than the cash industry. they can flood the world with their marketing, and they're assisted by big tech at the same time, because big tech naturally aligns with any automation processes, and that's what these guys do. So Google, Apple, every tech company will also naturally support their narrative.
Mm.
And so this is why you need to culturally fight back on, to be like, this isn't actually our story that we keep on saying about the inconvenience of cash. It comes from somewhere else. Mm. I can give you many, many examples of like literal propaganda campaigns that these players have run over the years.
So they're quite intentionally doing this and orchestrating it.
Very, very intentionally. I mean, MasterCard has like actively funded research to try and put disinformation about cash's like health risks into the media.
It's a disease vector.
Way before the pandemic.
Oh, really?
They've actively done this stuff, which is ironic because all the card terminals and touch screens actually have a higher transmission rate than something like cash would, because the surface is harder. So epidemiologists, if you were to say, you know, what's a safer system, they'd say, if you're touching a screen, it has much higher transmission than something like paper.
Interesting.
Cash is much safer because literally the pores in paper don't actually, you know, but perceptively people imagine that like, oh, well, cash is dirty or something. And these guys literally will fund research, selective research, to tell you that kind of stuff, right? And they've been very, very successful at it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You're listening to 3CR 855 AM on digital and on the internet. www.3cr.org.au.
You know, this issue of the central banks not supporting the continued use of cash, we're seeing industry around cash fold, because the armored cars industry are having a lot of trouble, and some of them are going bankrupt because they don't have enough work anymore, because the big businesses are no longer transporting so much cash to the banks.
Yeah, well, if you don't support the cash system, it starts to become uneconomic for the various logistics players to be involved in it.
Mm.
So they'll start to consolidate, or they'll start to shut down and stuff. And this is why, you know, a state or a central bank should be treating the cash system as a kind of strategic, you know, states will support the farming industry because they believe it's a strategic priority to keep your farmers going. And there's a similar thing with the cash industry. It's like the network circuitry of capitalism tries to make everything faster constantly, but in so doing, it'll make systems more unstable. And you suddenly have a crisis and the whole system falls down. This is why you need to actually protect these systems.
Would you encourage the average Joe then to start pulling out notes and coins out of their wallets when they're going shopping?
Absolutely. And I'd also encourage them to start thinking about this in terms of the broader processes happening in the world around big tech.
Mm.
Because this is the same thing, you know, when you ask yourself, oh, should I be reading a book rather than reading everything on a screen? Should I be using my brain or should I use AI? It's like, yeah, you're going to be pushed towards ever more automation because that's what you're supposed to do in an accelerating system. But you got to ask yourself, do you want to be that person who's constantly being pushed down that route? Or do you want to start to build a different way of being?
Mm.
Say, I'm not going to be told constantly that there's something wrong with me for just wanting something tactile and physical.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and for MMT activists, this is important because the cash system is the most sort of down-to-earth element of the state money system, which is often where lots of MMT thinking goes towards. So I think it should be incorporated as one of the elements in MMT thinking.
Yeah, I think it makes sense if you understand your MMT, it makes sense why you would want to see cash continue in the way we operate with each other using money.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Wondering what you're seeing around the globe as far as legislation to protect the use of cash. I saw that recently the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, the ACCC, has stated that businesses get to choose what form of payment they want. So that's why in Australia that businesses can say, well, we'll only accept card, or we'll only accept cash, or we'll do a mix of them.
Yeah, the business community is a very small subset of society, and often they are being pushed towards the so-called cashlessness.
Mm.
And they often become the main vector via which it transmits. So The reason why in London people have sort of lost belief in cash is precisely that these small businesses started refusing it. And then they sort of learn culturally that there's something wrong with cash. So if you want to curb that, you really do actually need systems that say you have to accept cash. Right now, there's different proposals around the world. In the US, the Payments Choice Act, the libertarians attack that because they're like, well, but then you're forcing businesses to do something that they don't want to do. But if you're an analyst of global capitalism, it's like, what will the businesses do? They'll do what the big tech sector is doing. And so, okay, if you let that system run, you're going to have a collapse of the cash system.
Yeah.
So you actually need to think about how you're going to break that, right? There's a lot of cash availability programs. So in the UK, for example, they'll try to like, okay, well, let's try to keep some bank branches open. Let's try to keep some ATMs open. But these are very weak measures because what they're not doing is they're often not actually coming out in support of cash. Going back to our sort of, you know, horse cart and sports car framing used by the fintech industry, the regulators imagine themselves as like coming in to sort of help the last of these people who use horse carts. They're like, we understand that you still use the horse cart and we will allow some space on the road still for you for a little while until you eventually get phased out. That's the way they think.
We'll keep a few stables around so you can put your horse in them.
Yeah, exactly. So this is when they're saying, okay, well, we'll try to keep some ATMs and stuff. That's the way they're thinking. They're not thinking proactively in terms of like a different framing around progress to say, actually, we really need to keep strategic balance of power in the monetary system, and we should actively try to promote an alternative.
Mm.
Like, that is what's missing right now in the official policy scene.
Mm.
Because they're so influenced by the existing corporate progress narratives that they often don't even understand this.
I think I'm going to start using that phrase, national strategic resilience. Maybe that'll get some views.
Yeah. People are trying. People are trying. You know, so it's a kind of nascent movement. And maybe the way to sort of think about the movement is just to think about the active transport type movements that built up in the wake of the automobile industry. So the automobile industry at one point was very, very culturally powerful. It was like progress means having cars. And right now we're in that phase with payments. It's like progress means getting rid of cash and only using the apps, right? But actually you could start to find a cultural backlash where people start to say, we want the payments equivalent of pedestrianized roads. We want alternatives to exist in our society.
I was going to ask whether you feel like you're a lone voice in all of this, but it seems like you've got your finger on the pulse in different areas.
Yeah, yeah. I think the hard thing is that there's still a bit of an education gap, shall we say, in lots of the campaigning, because many people have an intuitive concern about cash going down, but they struggle to articulate why exactly. And so they'll start campaigns often, but they'll often turn to conspiracy theories, or they'll often incorrectly characterize the situation. But hey, there are all sorts of different methods often work. But many people often feel that they struggle to understand the monetary system itself. So when they're trying to articulate arguments for their intuitions around cash, they struggle to get it out properly in a way. And so part of my work in the cash field is helping groups to articulate those arguments. So on my Substack, I have one section called Cash Back, which is trying to explain some of those background arguments.
Well, that comes back to where we began really, which is why is it important to understand monetary systems? Before we let you go here, tell us again where people can find your work and how they might support you in your work.
Sure. The main place now is Substack, so Altered States of Monetary Consciousness, or Asimoko.
I wondered how you pronounce that. Asimoko. Okay.
Yeah. And then that's www.asomo.co. It's got a dot. The co is now the sort of domain. And that's where a lot of my new work is. And if you're interested in the economic anthropology stuff, I have a course on there, which is called Econ Life 101.
Mm-hmm.
There's also my book, Cloud Money, which came out in 2022. That was very specific on cash and crypto and stuff like that.
Terrific. That'll orient people to this whole issue. Well, really appreciate your time here with us today, Brett. So thanks so much for coming along.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Brett. Thanks very much.
Hello, I'm Philip Lawn. I'm adjunct professor at Torrens University, and you're listening to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev on 3CR Community Radio.
Hey, Anne, I've got a confession to make. I've actually become more digitized than ever before. I've just started using the app on my phone as opposed to a plastic card for transactions. I'm feeling a bit guilty because, like, also I like vinyl records. I love their covers and the rest of it. Mm-hmm. But for the convenience, I listen to digital music all the time.
Convenience will be the death of us, Kevin.
Yeah. The one thing that does confuse me is the surcharge because did I ever tell you the first job I ever got out of school? I worked at the Commonwealth Bank for about 2 months, and I was the juniorest clerk at the 21 Swanston Street in Melbourne at the CBA, which is no longer there. It's been knocked down.
Okay.
And I had to count, like double count. We had to double count everything. I never had my hands on cash. That was for the tellers, but we'd have payment slips and that sort of thing. It was very laborious. Mm. And so you think about using cash and you think about the labour that's required.
It's labour intensive, isn't it, behind the scenes?
Yeah, and yet a cash transaction attracts no surcharge. And then you think about the automated payments and they attract a surcharge. And I think to myself, why is this attracting a surcharge? This has got to be more efficient than paying in cash.
Mm.
This should attract a deduction, you know? So that offends me, and that's
oh dear! Don't put the idea out there that we have to be charged for using cash.
Well, no, we never were before, and so why should we now?
Mm.
The other thing about cash is that I work as a handyman, and sometimes I get paid in cash, and then I have to worry about the cash. Like I've got to keep it with me. If I lose my cash, it's gone, never to be seen again. Whereas if I have a dodgy transaction online, I can usually recover the money through my banking system.
Mm.
So there are these things which kind of work against the cash.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't want an only cash system either.
No, you don't want an only cash system, but we don't want a cashless system either.
Mm. It's interesting to think about that example that we mentioned last time with Brett, which is what does it look like when you force people off cash and you force them onto digital money? And that's what happens with this so-called cashless welfare.
Yeah.
You know, we saw all sorts of things where the lack of being able to use cash was denying people all these different kinds of experiences. So, for example, it's a well-known phenomenon that people on low incomes will often budget by dividing their physical cash up into, say, 7 for each day. That helps them to budget their money.
Yeah.
So you can't do that when you've got a digital card. They couldn't give their kids pocket money.
Yeah.
And, of course, as we were saying, they're at the mercy of technology. So these cards only work at certain grocery shops. And so when that thing was out, they couldn't buy their groceries.
It also forces them to shop at those locations.
Mm.
You can't go to your independent grocer because they're not part of the scheme. Or you can't go to a farmer's market because it's cash only. So you miss out on all the bargains. It forces them into a mainstream economy where they have to feed the big players.
Yeah, it's an example of how centralized and authoritarian it has the potential to be and how this technology can really be used to undermine your sort of personal agency and even exclude you socially because these cards are recognized at the cash register. And, you know, these things happen incrementally. So at the moment, it might not look like a big thing because there's a war on cash, but incrementally, the less and less opportunity you have to use it, the more you might notice, as Brett says, the more it might start to feel oppressive.
Yeah, it erodes your individual choice. Now, I'm not jumping on the libertarian wagon here, but to be forced into a system where your choices are removed in the name of servicing profit and it's politically driven, less so than practically driven.
Yeah, and of course the same technology that gives them these great profits from being involved in our many small digital transactions every day, it's also giving them a lot of data.
Yeah.
And that's where you get into these issues of surveillance and censorship of a population.
Yeah.
So, as Brett said, it's quite intentional, and the propaganda that we're receiving that cash is old-fashioned rather than that cash is a parallel system that we need, like, you know, stairs versus elevators.
it's a stable foundation as opposed to a an old-fashioned system. You know, it's stairs. You're very happy that stairs are there when the lift doesn't work, and that's a good analogy.
In fact, that's an analogy that really rings true for me, because I know some certain people who were living in Brisbane during the Brisbane flood, and they're up on the 26th floor of one of the high rises. And of course, the lifts went out because the basement of the building got flooded.
Ah.
And they literally had to go down 26 floors to do their grocery shopping.
Oh, wow.
And I think there was a woman there on the 10th floor with a jug of water.
Selling lemonade for 5 cents a glass halfway down.
Being an enterprising capitalist. Yeah. But yeah, you sort of wonder to yourself, well, how can we take on the fintech industry? Because they seem so powerful. And this one, I think, Kevin, is pretty simple. That's the good news. It's pretty simple to counter some of this. All you have to do is use cash. It's simple.
Yeah. It's the sort of thing that if it happened en masse, it might work. I wonder about how this is all going to play out. It seems no matter what we do, they get us one way or another. and as I said, I've been weak. I'm falling over to the convenience.
I hope you're not going to be like somebody I know who has their card on their Apple Watch and she had to contort herself into all these weird positions just to try and get the reader to read her watch.
I have pondered the convenience of having a chip inserted into my wrist so that I could open doors automatically and just wave my way through keys. Like if you're a tradie and you're carrying stuff and you're going up all these stairs and you've got things hanging off all over the place and you get to the door and you've got to get your keys out of your pocket and put everything down. It's just having a little chip that I could just wave.
You want the implant.
Yeah.
Oh, Kev's making a great case there for this.
Yeah. I'm not helping this discussion at all, really, am I? However, look, underpinning all of this, there has to be the opt-out.
There has to be.
The opt-out, and the opt-out in this situation is cash.
That's what we're aiming for.
So if I had a chip inserted in my wrist, I'd need to have the ability to turn it off so that it's not there.
Well, I'm glad you've seen the light, Kevin. And my source of hope on this one really is that I think the central banks will never allow there to only be privatized money in the system. That's my hope anyway.
You say that, but geez, who knows?
That's another wrap for us today, Kev. That's another show under our belts. The war on cash, it's an interesting one, and we'll be back again.
In a couple of weeks' time to do it all again.
We will. We'll do it all over again. So we'll see you then, Kev.
Okay, catch you, Anne. Bye.
You've been listening to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev.
We'd love your feedback. Email us on radiommt@gmail.com or search Radio MMT on social media.
Listen to this show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or on 3cr.org.au/radioMMT.
Support this show and the station by subscribing to 3cr.org.au and mention Radio MMT.
We thank all our guests.
And we thank economist Professor Bill Mitchell and his MMTED.org, educating masses on modern monetary theory.
And thank you to our listening listeners for listening. And I thank you, Kevin.
And I thank you, Anne. So what's planned for next week?
Kevin, there is still so much to talk about. We've got to expose all this rotten economics.
Well, yeah, that's good, and I get it. Do you reckon we could use a bit more music?
Well, I made a list of all these terrible economic theories. Like, I've heard of the theory of comparative advantage, or the quantity theory of money, or the loanable funds theory.
Have you heard of a band called Single Gun Theory? Like, they're a really good band. I'm sure there's a whole range of, like, macroeconomic music that I could bring into the show.
Yeah, but we really need to do marginal productivity theory, not to mention the natural rate of unemployment and the money multiplier.
You've got a pretty good singing voice. I play bass. Bill, he plays guitar. I reckon we could form a macroeconomic band. Like, we could deliver this whole message by music.
Well, we could call the band the Permanent Income Hypothesis, or the Ricardian Equivalence, or Rational Expectations.
I think we're onto something here. We're trying to make macroeconomics more interesting to the masses. We're going to, like, form this band and sing it to them. And we're going to bring the economists in. We're going to get music.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.